Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Léonie de Jonge, author of The Success and Failure of Right-Wing Populist Parties in the Benelux Countries, published in June by Routledge. To quote political scientist Kas Muda, the populist radical right is by far the best-studied party family within political science. This may be true, but as Professor de Jonge points out in her new book, less studied have been the specific conditions under which right-wing populism has succeeded, and perhaps more importantly, failed. For instance, why are these parties polling above 40% in Italy and France, yet remain absent in Portugal and Ireland? At least some of the answer could lie in the Benelux, the political and economic union made up of the Netherlands, Luxembourg and Belgium. More precisely, as my guest makes clear, Benelux offers a comparative case study between, on the one hand, the Netherlands and Dutch-speaking Flanders, and on the other, Luxembourg and French-speaking Wallonia. Léonie de Jonge is assistant professor in European politics and society at the University of Groningen. She graduated from Cornell College, Iowa, and Cambridge, where she also obtained her PhD in 2019. Léonie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a really interesting study. I say this because I've followed Dutch and federal Belgian politics for a long time. And in fact, I did three podcasts before the Dutch election this year, one of which was on the Dutch New Right with Marijn Oudenhamse. But I've got to admit, Luxembourg politics were a completely closed book to me, and I haven't given much thought to the diverging political systems in Flanders and Wallonia. So first of all, can you talk us through the development of this idea? First of all, how you got it, and then how you developed it academically, and how long it took.
Yes, so it's quite a personal story because I grew up to Dutch parents in Luxembourg, and I grew up in a village, and I knew the Netherlands mostly from my family, and I knew the Netherlands as the way in which the Netherlands sells itself to the outside, a very open, tolerant, progressive country. Mm-hmm. But then growing up, all of a sudden in the Netherlands, you saw this shift towards the far right, so the rise of Pim Fortuyn. And after that, Geert Wilders and now Thierry Baudet. So there are quite a lot of far-right movements in the Netherlands. But that didn't happen in Luxembourg. And to me, that just was so puzzling because the average Luxembourgian that I met in the streets seemed more conservative than the average Dutch person that I knew from the media. So I just couldn't get my head around why is it that these movements do so well in the Netherlands, but not in Luxembourg. And then when you look at what lies between Luxembourg and the Netherlands, the puzzle becomes even more complicated because you have Belgium, and Belgium is such an interesting country, super complex politically, but then a northern sort of rather wealthy Dutch-speaking part with a historically very strong far-right movement, and then a more poor industrial southern part, French-speaking, where there is no far-right movement despite a perfect breeding ground. And that's how the question for my research came up. Why is it that right-wing populist parties tend to do better in the Netherlands and in Flanders than in Luxembourg and in Wallonia?
And I saw that in the introduction to the book, you talked about people you had worked with or run the thesis by that included people like Kas Muda, who is a specialist in this area. Was it something they felt had been underexplored?
Well, the funny thing is that when I actually started my PhD, so that was in 2015, right? So just before Brexit and before Trump, I had to, in the first year, you have a sort of a defense where you need to defend your idea in front of a committee. And the committee at the time said, you know, this is just a little bit outdated. You should really be looking at the rise of left-wing populism, because obviously we'd had the financial crisis and we had at the time movements like Podemos and Syriza in Spain and Greece that it looked like there would be a rise of left-wing populist movements. But I managed to persuade them that it was actually quite a timely question to study this difference in electoral support for far-right parties across the continent. And ever since 2016, no one ever asked me about the relevance anymore about this study.
It is a good point, though, actually. I mean, there is, you know, there certainly appear to be more books on right-wing populism than on Syriza and Podemos, at least in English.
Yeah, and that's not a coincidence, because the far right is simply much more successful in Europe. So every time I go into media afterwards, I receive comments saying, well, what about the left? You should be studying left-wing or far-left movements. But they're simply less strong in Europe. And that in and of itself is a fascinating question, right? Like, why is it that left-wing populist movements are less successful than right-wing populist movements? Mm. I think that would be an interesting study in and of itself. But having said that, the far-right is simply really, net support for far-right parties has grown substantially over the last decades in Europe. And that's the puzzle of this book that keeps me up at night. Why is it that this net support is not spread equally across the continent? Why is it that some countries and regions have more far-right support than others?
Mm. Well, actually, a good place to start is the use of the correct term. So, you know, you have it in the title, and you spell it out early on in the book, your definition of a right-wing populist party, because, you know, a lot of us tend to use words like far right, extreme right, and obviously populist has become very popular. But you do seem, you come up with a very specific definition that would tend to leave out parties, you know, really extreme parties like, say, Golden Dawn in Greece. So could you talk us through what that definition is and how these parties differ from parties like Golden Dawn?
Yes. So the parties that I am interested in are what I call right-wing populist parties, and for the very simple reason that they are first and foremost right-wing, so operating on the right-wing of the political spectrum, the far-right end of that, second of all, that they're populists. So it's really, really pragmatic solution. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is these are parties that are nativist, so super nationalist, and also xenophobic, not just nationalist, but nationalist and xenophobic, which is why they're called nativist. Mm-hmm. Second, they have a tendency towards authoritarianism, meaning they believe in strictly ordered societies. And thirdly, they're populist. And populist is like an additional attribute that can be attached to this, which suggests that they believe in a society that is divided into two groups, two homogenous groups. On the one hand, the pure and virtuous people, and on the other hand, the corrupt and evil elite who are out to get them. So that makes them right-wing populists. Now, what differs them from the extreme right is that right-wing populist parties, in general, still play by the rules of democracy. And so in very, very general terms, they do not call for violence. They do not try to eradicate democratic systems. They do not try to get rid of elections. They still play by the rules of the game. Now, having said that, I should also say that, so we use the term far right as an umbrella term to include these radical right-wing parties that I study and the extreme right parties that are sort of operating outside of the democratic realm. But the line between the extreme right and the radical right, or the populist radical right, is blurring. And that is something that has been increasingly happening in the last 2 or 3 years. So that I think if I were to write the book again, I would probably just stick with far-right parties.
Do you say that because you're thinking of somebody like Baudet and how he has You know, he started out perhaps appearing to be something relatively new and then sort of revealed himself to be, you know, very deeply entrenched in typical European far-right thought. Or are you thinking more broadly than that?
No, Baudet is definitely a symptom of that trend, but it's more than just Baudet. It happens elsewhere, but definitely in the Netherlands, we see that, we now have actually four right-wing populist parties in parliament, and that's quite interesting because it's a country that doesn't have historic roots to the far right. So unlike Flanders, where there's a very strong historic far-right movement, in the Netherlands, this is quite a recent trend that these parties are doing well in parliament. But you have a lot of diversity within this far-right party family. And Baudet is definitely the more radical on the side. And I would even call his party an extreme right party. It really ticks the most of the boxes. It's overtly racist. It has said anti-Semitic things. It constantly pushes the boundaries of what we deem acceptable. And so, yes, with this party, you see that the lines between the radical right, the populist radical right, and the far right or the extreme right are really blurring.
But I raise that because I'm thinking that perhaps the opposite is happening somewhere like France, where, you know, Marine Le Pen and her father tried this very extreme right-wing version. It got them so far, but not far enough. And as a result, she's now trying to tap into the more traditional right of the centre-right vote. So do you think what you're describing is a pan-continental trend or something that's quite confined to the Netherlands and perhaps to Belgium?
That's a super interesting question. I think that observation that you make that we see sort of a reverse trend in France is super interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way. But you're right that in France, we've seen a de-diabolisation, so the attempt to de-demonize the party and appear more acceptable. Whereas in the Netherlands, we're seeing radicalization on the far right end of the fringe. But of course, the situation is quite different. So in France, these parties are not in power and they're trying to rally as much support as they can. In the Netherlands, they have seats in parliament. And after they have entered the political arena, then they started to shift to the far, far and extreme right. So I think that you could say in the French case, it's really a strategy of acquiring support. And also because of the two-party system in France or the first-past-the-post system, they need to try to appeal to a very, very large crowd. Whereas in the Netherlands, you can get a seat in parliament with 0.6% of the vote.
Yeah.
So it's a very different question. Now, if we look at Belgium, there you see that the Flemish Interest Party, which again is a very historically strong far-right movement, has also tried to become more socially acceptable, has tried to rid themselves of the stigma of extremism. But in recent years, because they are all in one movement, they have attracted some sort of new far-right figures, such as Dries van Langenhoven, very comparable to Thierry Baudet. And the leader of the party, Tom van Grieken, is struggling to keep them all together, so to appeal to these various factions, the extreme right and the radical right factions within the support base. And in the Netherlands, it's quite simple that these parties just split into smaller sections because the party system makes that possible. It wouldn't be possible in other countries.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Do you think the Dutch case is unique in that you have this almost perfect PR system? So it's you have very little interest as any party actually to federate. You have more of an interest to break down into very specific interest groups.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's not a coincidence that we now have 19 political parties in our parliament, right? The Dutchification of politics is there's a reason it's called Dutchification, because the Netherlands are trendsetter in the splintering of political parties into smaller sections, and that is definitely facilitated by the very pure electoral system. And that also partly helps explain the success of far-right movements in the Netherlands, because it's relatively easy for new parties to enter into the political arena, much more easy than in, say, the UK.
Oh yeah, it's very difficult here, but we'll come back to that because that's a very interesting point. Because I've diverted you away from your book, and I want to come back to some of the generic factors you identify in the rise of these parties. So in particular, you break down the demand and the supply side, which is very interesting in itself. And then you look at the role of the media, the mainstream parties, and this what you call the breakthrough, the critical importance of the breakthrough moment. Can you talk us through each of those concepts, if you remember, because it was quite a long question. So start with the demand and supply issue.
Maybe it makes more sense to start with the breakthrough, because the first question, of course, is how do you define success? That was the first thing. When you start writing and working on a PhD, you need to always define your key concepts. And I had these concepts that were that really caused me quite a bit of headache. So first one being the right-wing populism, which is such a difficult term, but I already talked about that. But then the second point is, okay, if you want to explain success and failure, you first need to clearly define what you mean by success and failure. When you look at a movement like, say, UKIP, which has been super influential but never really held many seats in parliament, can you then define success simply by seats in parliament? So obviously that wasn't a very good definition to me. So I had to come up with something more narrow. And one way to think about it is to think about success in two ways. There are two dimensions of success, at least two. And one is electoral persistence. So once you broke through, how long do you manage to stick around? And the other one is the breakthrough moment in itself. And that's the one that I'm interested in. So the first moment in which a party or player becomes accepted as a relevant political player, so has coalition potential, really manages to stir the media, to raise attention, to move and shake things. That's what I'm interested in, the first moment in which a party breaks through electorally. So that's the success question.
Yeah, although you make a very interesting point, which is it needn't just have coalition potential. It can also have blackmail potential, you say.
That's right.
Which is, yeah. So could you give examples of, the coalition example is, there are many of those.
Yes.
But the blackmail example, could you give us
an
example?
So the coalition potential isn't enough because, say, the Flemish Interest Party, for instance, doesn't really have coalition potential because it's systematically outsided by other parties of a cordon sanitaire against this party. But it has blackmail potential. And blackmail potential essentially is the power to push other parties to move in your direction. And the far-right parties in many countries have that potential. It means that you sort of, because you are becoming a strong player or you risk to become a strong player, you manage to set the agenda and persuade or coerce other parties to take on some of your agenda items or start copying you in some ways. And this is definitely something we see in many countries.
Well, so repeatedly with Nigel Farage in the UK and seeing it now with the Trumpists in the Republican Party. I mean, that brings us to a very broad point that you make, and you also discuss individually with two countries and the two regions, which is this idea of whether the media and mainstream parties ought to operate a cordon sanitaire, or whether there are sometimes cases for co-opting parties. And I can think of examples where co-opting these parties has actually destroyed them. The one would be the True Finns. Mm-hmm. Another, we'll see what happens to them, but the Five Star Movement in Italy, the Independent Greeks with when they went into a government with Syriza. But I guess the one terrible example people think of where it went very, very wrong was von Papen bringing Hitler into government in the 1930s. It wasn't clear to me if you took a side in your book on whether one was a good idea or one was not. Could you expand on that?
You put your finger on the sore spot already, because I'm quite agnostic at the end of the day about it's not sadly, it's not sort of a recipe for how to deal with the far right, because it's very complicated. Because ultimately, what the book doesn't say is whether or not it's good or bad for democracy to sort of put these parties offside, to isolate them and to put a cordon sanitaire around them. What does it tell us about the quality of democracy in these polities? But maybe I take a step back for a second to explain first why, sort of the answer to the puzzle, right? Why is it that right-wing populist parties do better in some countries than in others, according to what I found? And I want to just go back to the demand and supply side framework that you touched on earlier. Because that is the metaphor of the marketplace, that you need to have demand for a party's breeding ground on the one hand, and on the other hand, a supply side, so a credible right-wing populist contender who can translate lingering demand into actual votes. This is the classical view of explaining the rise and failure of right-wing populist parties across the board. So on the one hand, a breeding ground, and on the other hand, a strong supply. And I started out with this two-dimensional framework, this traditional way of looking at or trying to explain the puzzle. And I wasn't quite satisfied by it, because when you first look at demand side features, you see actually there is a breeding ground for right-wing populist movements in all European countries and also across the Benelux region. And if anything, it would be especially strong in Wallonia, because there the socio-political and socio-economic situation makes that region particularly prone to a far-right political contender, in the sense that there's a lot of unemployment, there is high immigration, and people are not fundamentally more xenophobic in that region than elsewhere. So to be short, the demand side wasn't a good explanation to really explain the variation. So then I looked at the supply side. And the supply side does help, because the supply side tells you, for instance, why is it possible for right-wing populist parties to translate lingering demand into votes? And there are things like the electoral system, which, to be sure, in all the Benelux countries, there's a PR system. But in the Netherlands, it's very pure, so it's really easy to gain, to break through. And also, the movements in these regions have been much stronger. So there have been charismatic leaders, there have been strong, well-organized, socially rooted movements that were able to rally support. But then again, the supply side doesn't fully explain the puzzle, because it would just be, you would say, well, there isn't a right-wing populist contender in Luxembourg and Wallonia just because there hasn't been one. But it doesn't tell us anything about, well, why hasn't there been one? Why hasn't there been a charismatic leader that managed to make their voices heard in the first place in these regions? And this was a very long intro to explain, well, this is how I then turn to my two key players, which are mainstream parties and the media, because they, in many ways, straddle this demand and supply side framework, because they are together the gatekeepers of the electoral arena. They determine whether or not a party, a new player, gets to enter or not. Mm. So...
Yeah, and you make this, I didn't know it until you mentioned it in the book, but I looked it up afterwards and saw that Roland Dumas admitted to it in his memoir in 2011. But this point you make that Mitterrand, in order to try and make trouble for the centre-right, he encouraged, first of all, a change to the electoral system to favor the Front National, and then to give more media exposure to Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Yes, that's sort of the best evidence for this case. So I tested in the conclusion, I test my theory on other cases, including France. And France is a case where, yes, it perfectly fits this theory.
Yeah. And I know because Maureen Adenhamser wrote about this too, this idea of the VVD being, in particular, the rise of Fritz Bolkestein and the people who came with him sort of encouraging the rise of the far right in the Netherlands. I'd be interested to hear your view on this. I tend to think that this is not always a bad thing, because sometimes, like Sarkozy, for example, you could argue that Sarkozy reduced the power of the Front National, at least for a period, by co-opting, you know, key parts of its ideas, but leaving aside the worst parts of it. You could say the same with the VVD. You could say the same with Margaret Thatcher here in the 1970s. Is that a view? Would you dismiss that entirely?
Yes, you come back to the question which I so nicely avoided, right? Yes. Whether or not what is the way for mainstream parties to respond to far-right challengers? Are you supposed to copy, take over some of their agenda items? Because obviously, and that's very important, these parties bring up issues that people do care about. So It's true that immigration is something that people have questions about. And so it makes sense to discuss it and to not completely avoid it. But it's the way in which you discuss these issues. To answer your question, I think mainstream parties and the media have a huge responsibility when it comes to legitimizing and creating increasing demand for far-right movements. And mainstream parties tend to see themselves, in particular mainstream parties, they tend to see themselves as the victim of the rise of the far-right. And my book shows that clearly they are not the victims, but they are important agents. And the reason is that they play a role in politicizing issues. And it's not just about, say, politicizing immigration and discussing immigration, but the way in which that is done. So if we look at Wallonia, a case where far-right parties have not been able to make a dent, there you see that immigration is discussed, but it's done in an economic question. It's an economic question. It's framed entirely as an economic question rather than a cultural one. And I think that is where mainstream parties have a big responsibility in the way in which topics are discussed, because they often end up legitimizing far-right ideologies if they start to co-opt the far-right. And that ultimately creates more demand for far-right ideas. And I think, and it's also important to note that my argument is really a twofold argument. This only works, so the demarcation strategy of ostracizing the far right, isolating it, it only works if the media and mainstream parties do so together. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work if it's just the media or if it's just mainstream parties and all parties need to do so. Then it becomes a purely, a really watertight cordon sanitaire, and that seems to work, and especially, and the timing is important, if this cordon sanitaire, it's put around it before the far right becomes big enough to matter, then they're really nipped in the butt. And that is what you see in Wallonia. Now to sort of the bigger question that this raises and that I raise in the conclusion and I don't have a clear answer to is whether or not this is good or bad for democracy. So can we say something about the quality of democracy? Is it the case that because we have far-right players in the Dutch parliament that our democratic system is somehow more in crisis than, say, in Luxembourg and Wallonia, where you have demand for these ideas, but they are not in parliament or not represented in parliament? They operate outside of the parliamentary arena. That's an age-old question, whether repressing such ideas and movements is better for democracy or not. And I think it's really a different question to try to analyze the quality of democracy. But what I do say is that far-right ideas are becoming normalized much faster if you have far-right players in parliament who spread these ideas and center-right parties and the media, a media system which legitimizes these ideas. Mm-hmm. Then it really becomes, these ideas become normalized. And that, I think, is very potentially harmful for democracy.
Right. Could we make this slightly micro? Because I think I was certainly interested, and I think listeners would be interested because of your personal knowledge of the special case of Luxembourg. Why a country that, as you point out, in 1961 had 13% foreign residents, in 2020 had 47%. and 70% of the workforce being non-nationals, that these ideas haven't really taken hold. Could you talk us through the specific case of Luxembourg?
Yeah, Luxembourg is such a fascinating case. It's often not included in comparative case studies because it's so small. And people also tend to say, well, it's different because it is such a micro country. You cannot really compare it. But actually, you can compare it because it has a party system just like any other country as well. There are 7 political parties that are operating. So it very much can be is comparable. But at the same time, it is unique in various ways. For instance, the fact that Luxembourg has about half the people who live in the country do not have a passport and therefore cannot participate in elections. Mm. So that makes a very strange demos in Luxembourg. There is a democratic deficit. But there are other things that make the country special. For instance, it's quite a wealthy country. And you could say, and this is what I often hear, people will say, yeah, but it's such a rich country, of course there is no demand for the far right. But then there are countries like Switzerland that are very wealthy as well, yeah. But there's a very strong far right. So wealth in and of itself doesn't explain why demand wouldn't be there. The demand is weaker in Luxembourg because center-right parties in particular have acted as a buffer on the rise of the far right. They have absorbed some of that demand because they still very closely connected to their electorates and still manage to keep people rather satisfied with the ways in which politics work. And of course, there is not that much supply because there is a movement, a party in Luxembourg that could be qualified as serving the function of a right-wing populist party, but it is by no way comparable to far-right parties in neighboring countries. And that is because you can simply not be openly anti-immigrant in Luxembourg because the entire economy is carried by non-nationals. So really, we have a lot of cross-country borders. We have a lot of non-nationals working in the economy. So the entire country would just entirely break down if there were no foreign support in keeping it afloat. And so some of these far-right ideas simply do not resonate or do not work. At the same time, there is now a rise of nationalism in Luxembourg because it does have its own national identity. There is a Luxembourgish language. And what's interesting is that far-right movements in Luxembourg have traditionally hibernated in these strong language associations who push the prominence of Luxembourgish language in the national debate. And by doing so, they politicize these feelings of the fear of being flooded by foreigners and the language dying out, and we need to do all these things to keep the language alive. And so these far-right ideas are sort of slowly introduced into national debates, and immigration is also increasingly being politicized as a cultural question. So I'm saying that just to make a point that Luxembourg is not immune to the rise of the far right. There could well be an increasing demand for far right movements.
Yeah, it's a, as you described there, like pure demand and supply issue operating. You finished this book at the end of last year, I believe you put it at the beginning. Are you working on anything new?
I am very fascinated by... Yeah, so my book is already outdated in the sense that the moment I sent it to Routledge, there was a new breakaway in the Dutch parliament. And ever since now, so we are constantly on our tippy toes here because we now have 4 right-wing populist parties in the Dutch parliament. So there's competition within the far-right party family. And I'm quite interested in the newer manifestations of these far-right movements. So when I ask you to close your eyes and picture a far-right actor, then what comes to mind still in most people's minds are things like hooligans or neo-Nazis or skinheads and sort of like these typical middle-aged white men. But that idea is so outdated and just not true anymore. So we increasingly see that far-right ideas resonate and are being pushed by intellectuals, people with university degrees, but also women. So it's really diversifying. And that is something I want to study in the future. So the face of the far right is changing. And I think as researchers, we need to study that and understand more why it is that it's changing and how it is changing.
Yeah. Well, and that's certainly the case in the Trumpist movement. It's incredibly diverse right-wing opinion, yeah. Okay, well, since this is a podcast about books, as always, I've asked my guests to recommend a couple. What have you chosen?
Yes, so first one for my field, and then one that is a bit more broader and personal. So for my field, I really like Hate in the Homeland by Cynthia Miller Idris. It is a fascinating account of the new global far right and the new far right in a sense that I just described, right? So she tells the story about how far right groups develop their cultural and intellectual capacities to mainstream their ideologies. So if you want to understand how far right movements across the globe gain influence both online and offline, then this book is for you.
Okay.
And then the second one, it's quite a different one. I chose Manual for Survival by Kate Brown. It's actually the story of the Chernobyl disaster, but okay. It's also so much more than that. It's about the human impact on the environment. It's about public health choices, and it's ultimately also about politics. And I read this during the first lockdown, and it just really struck a chord with me. So I really recommend that.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And today I've been talking to Léonie de Jonge about her success and failure of right-wing populist parties in the Benelux countries. Léonie, thanks very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.